This is PCJ Radio on 88.2 FM. This is PCJ Radio on 107.5 FM in Nairobi, Kenya. And nationwide on 5. This is PCJ Radio on KBCT in Waco, Texas. This is PCJ Radio on 9955 kilohertz to Latin America. This is PCJ Radio on 7590 kilohertz DRM. On shortwave, satellite, and the internet, this is PCJ Radio. Media Network Plus, produced and presented by Paulette McQuarrie and Keith Perron.
Hello, and welcome to the program. Well, in 7 days' time, the annual Shortwave Listeners Winter Festival will take place in Plymouth Meeting, Pennsylvania. Keith will be joining us for an audio diary about last year's fest. We also have a special documentary on what it's like working as a foreign correspondent in China. This is Media Network Plus. If you attempt to hack us, we will hack you back. First, here's Keith with a look at some of the headlines from the world of media.
Arabsat announced that the European international news broadcaster, Euronews, has renewed its contract with Arabsat to continue broadcasting Euronews Arabic on Arabsat for 5 more years, covering the Middle East, Africa, and portions of Western Europe. Arnaud Verhaek, the deputy director for worldwide distribution at Euronews, said Arabsat is one of the strongest partners since the launch of Euronews on the Arabsat in Arabic in 2008. In a very competitive market, we are pleased to renew our cooperation with Arabsat and secure the deployment of the MENA area, where Euronews now reaches 38 million households. Sky News Arabic's Twitter and Facebook accounts were hacked by the pro-regime Syrian activists this week. A group referring to itself as the Syrian Electronic Army, or SEA, took over the 24-hour news channel's main Twitter accounts about midnight, along with its Facebook page. Sky News Araba responded later in the day, saying that all of its social media platforms have been reactivated and were functioning normally. Sky News Araba started broadcasting to more than 50 million homes from its Abu Dhabi headquarters last May. The incoming BBC Director General, Tony Hall, announced that following nearly 5 months as Acting Director General, Tim Davies' new role at BBC Worldwide has been expanded to incorporate a more strategic global perspective. As CEO, BBC Worldwide, and Director, Davies will be responsible for developing the BBC's international brand and editorial strategy. This week, a U.S. company released information that pointed the finger to China when it comes to hacking computers owned by Western interests. What is damning about this report is it directly links the People's Liberation Army and a building and address located in Shanghai. Grady Summers is the vice president of the security firm involved, Mendiant.
Comet Crew is a name that a lot of security researchers have given to this group that we call APT-1. They're called that because of the way that they do what's called command and control, the way they talk to their servers on the internet. But what's most important is the evidence we've provided that links this Comet Crew, or APT-1, to a unit of the Chinese People's Liberation Army, Unit 61398. That's important because this is the first time that researchers like Mandiant have been able to establish that link. We've long thought that these attacks have come from China. Now we've given evidence to show that not only do they come from China, but they're actually sponsored by the Chinese government. Yeah, we actually don't advocate going on the offense. We think that creates more problems than it solves. It's a really popular thing to talk about nowadays. But we believe there's no technical or legislative problem or solution to this problem. We think it's going to be a combination of better defense by organizations, but also diplomatic pressure that Washington can bring to bear on Beijing on this matter.
That was Grady Summers, the vice president of the security firm involved, Mendiant. China has denied the claims. And with that, we've come to the end of this look at some of the main news headlines this week from the world of media. For more information, I invite you to check out the weblog from Dr. Kim Andrew Elliott. You can find Kim Andrew Elliott's blog at our own website by going to pcjmedia.com, and you'll find a link for it at the bottom of the page.
From March 1st to 2nd this year, the annual SWL Winterfest will take place in Plymouth Meeting, Pennsylvania. This year marks the 26th anniversary of this event. Last year, for the 25th anniversary, Keith made his way from Taipei to the United States to take part. He joins us now with an audio diary of what happened last year.
In a few days' time, it'll be exactly 1 year that I was preparing for an extremely long trip. And that was to venture off to the Shortwave Listeners Fest in Plymouth Meeting, Pennsylvania. Last year, they celebrated their 25th anniversary. And for the 25th anniversary, they extended the festival by 1 day. So instead of being 2 days, it was 3 days. The funny thing about it, and something that pops up in my head every now and again, is why didn't I go about 20 years ago when I was living in Montreal? It would have meant just driving down to Pennsylvania. No, instead I had to do things the easy way and wait till I was living on the other side of the globe to fly. The night before departing for the airport, I'd packed all my bags. I'd finished doing that around 3:30 in the morning. Then I went to bed, slept for exactly 2 hours before I had to wake up and get ready to head to the Taoyuan International Airport. The first thing I did before I headed off to the airport was, well, make a very strong cup of coffee. Now, this only took seconds because I don't grind the coffee beans and brew coffee the old-fashioned way. No, I'd use a more modern method, coffee pods. After I made my coffee, I decided to save time, so I brought my coffee to the bathroom and have a shower. And as I was having a shower, also brushed my teeth. After I did all that and got dressed, well, it was time to head to the airport. And this is where the real part of the journey began. First, let me explain to the trip. Taipei, Hong Kong, and then New York. Now, the flight from Taipei to Hong Kong is only about 2 hours. The flight, however, from Hong Kong to New York, 19 and a half hours. Oy vey.
I was toting my pack along the dusty when a mucker rode it, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas covered load. If you're going to win a muck-a-mack with me, you can ride. So I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, bud, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man, I've been everywhere.
After we took off from Hong Kong International Airport, my thinking was, well, what do I do to amuse myself for the next 19 hours? Personally, I find it very difficult to sleep on an airplane, so that wasn't an option. Instead, I decided to surf the internet and watch the entertainment that was on the in-flight system. So I watched some episodes of Top Gear, some vintage comedy episodes like Yes Minister and Yes Prime Minister, a couple of movies, had a few drinks every now and again, walked up and down the aisle to get a little bit of exercise, surfed the internet, and continued to do that, so on, and so on, and so on.
Houston, Kingston, Texas, Canada, Monterey, Ferry Day, Santa Fe, Tallahassee, Glen Rock, Black Rock, Little Rock, Arkansas, Tennessee, Hennessy, Chippewa, Spirit Lake, Grand Lake, Devil Lake, Cradle Lake, the Beach Lake, I've been everywhere, man, I've been everywhere, man.
Then about 2 hours before we were about to land, I fell asleep. This wasn't because I was tired, this was because the movie that I was watching was so incredibly boring. I should have watched it earlier on in the flight, come to think of it. And then all of a sudden, I was woken up by this.
Flight present indication, subject to ATC. We should be landing before 8 o'clock. And hopefully have you at the terminal disembarking just after 8 o'clock. 13 hour time difference between Hong Kong and... Okay, time now
Yes, the pilot of Cathay Pacific, saying that we'll be landing in New York City in a few moments.
Start spreading the news. I'm leaving today. I want to be a part of it. New York, New York. Please.
Well, the long leg of the trip was done. There was still the short leg, New York City to Philadelphia, and then from Philadelphia to Plymouth Meeting. But I'm saying to myself, I'm in New York City. I should at least enjoy it for one night and do some stuff. And that's exactly what I did.
I want to wake up in a city that doesn't sleep and find I'm king of the hill.
Now, having been awake more than 20 hours, I was feeling a little tired, so I eventually headed back to my hotel at 11 o'clock at night, because I knew that I had to wake up bright and early to get a suit made and to buy some things in New York City that I needed to bring with me, and also to meet up with Thomas Witherspoon. Now, Thomas Witherspoon is the guy who started Ears to Our World. Now, we've been communicating back and forth by email for a number of years. But I asked him, could you arrange the tickets, because I wasn't quite sure how to do it, because at the time I was still in Taiwan, and he did. So he organized the bus ticket, and that way we were able to make our way from New York City to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Oh man, was it ever raining that day. From New York, we made our way to the Philadelphia train station, where from there we caught a taxi to Plymouth Meeting, right to the door of the DoubleTree Inn, where the SWL Fest was taking place. When I finally arrived at the DoubleTree Inn in Plymouth Meeting, Pennsylvania, one of the first things I wanted to do after checking in was to get a nice 3 or 4 hour nap. Well, that didn't exactly happen. As I was removing the bags from the boot of the cab, I was walking into the hotel, and off, maybe not too far away, a couple of meters, I went, "Oh my God!" That's not me. Somebody else said that. And there he was, Sheldon Harvey, host of the International Radio Report that I have been listening to for a number of years. In fact, it was through his show more than 20 years ago that I first heard about the SWL Fest. Now, Sheldon and I hadn't seen each other in, I think 15 years. So that was a little bit of a shock. After I checked in and went to my room, I thought, well, what should I do next? Maybe I'll relax for a bit. But then I remembered, wait a second, today people are arriving. I'd arrived the day before the 3-day event. So I thought, well, let me take this opportunity to take a shower again, get dressed, and then kind of walk around and see what else was going on. It was quite amazing, I have to say. Not too many people had arrived yet. I was one of the early arrivals. It was probably around 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon. But people were starting to trickle in slowly but surely. I met Richard Cuff and John Figliozzi finally. We talked for a bit. And then I was sort of seeing if there was anybody else there. And you can always figure out who these people were. You knew who was there for the SWL Fest. There was no doubt about that. What was interesting is that while I was in the lobby, I decided to make a few phone calls that I had to make to Taiwan. And I had two people coming up to me and said, "Ah, Keith." Two people I had never met in my life, but they'd recognize my voice from this program. That was quite interesting. During the course of the afternoon, the evening, I kept running into people who were listeners, who I communicated with by email or at some point talked with over Skype. That was also quite amusing. And I remember on the night before everything was about to begin, there was a kind of a complimentary room where they had beer and soft drinks set up. And I just went down there and I met somebody who I hadn't seen in some time. And we started talking. And all of a sudden, off in the distance, I heard, "Keith, is that you?" It was Dave Marthouse, who we interviewed not too long ago on another subject. He was there. Quite interesting indeed. Eventually that night, I decided to go to bed early because a friend of mine was also coming down from Montreal to take part in the fest. Now, we also hadn't seen each other in a number of years, and he was actually coming down for the fest and also to see me. But I'll tell you about him in just a little moment. The next day, as I got up and went down for breakfast, you can see everybody there. Everybody was getting ready for some of the first seminars that were taking place. There was one seminar in particular that I wanted to go to, and that was the talk about Radio Free Asia. Andrew Janacek, who works at Radio Free Asia, was there to talk a little bit about what RFA does. Later on, as we were leaving, I caught up with him and, well, I had to do an interview with him in the hallway.
Radio Free Europe, Voice of America, have been around for decades. Radio Free Asia has been around only since 1996. And what we tell people when they come to visit Radio Free Asia is we came about basically because of Tiananmen Square. In 1989, people that were living in China's own capital didn't even know what was going on down the street from them. In the United States, people like Congress were saying, we need to do something like a Radio Free Europe to help the people of China find out what's going on in their own inside their own borders. Legislation came up in 1994 and was approved for the creation of Radio Free Asia. And in September 1996, we went on with our first broadcast. And we've been doing it for over 15 years now.
Now, one of the things about the festival that I know is very popular and goes on every year are the amount of pirate stations that were on the air. Now, before I headed to the SWL Fest, I thought to myself, you know what? I should do the same thing. So I had a small 5-watt FM transmitter, and I set up a station. I was broadcasting for 3 days. I was broadcasting everything. PCJ programming, programming from Radio Australia, BBC, a lot of silly things. And as I was listening to my own thing going out, I'm like, well, let's see who else is out there. And I did that, and I tuned around the FM dial and came across two other pirates. Now, one of them, it was being operated by somebody I know. So I'm like, let's do a bit of a, you know, covert operation here and head over to where he is. One of the other things about the SWL Fest that's actually quite interesting is not just the forums that take place, but also the radio activity. And you're saying to yourself, wait a second, what do you mean by radio activity? Well, we have to be quiet about it, you know, but there are, of course, a number of pirates on the premise. Myself included. We're going to be heading to one of them right now to look at his setup. It is quite fascinating. In some ways, it makes it look like a Dr. Wizard experience going mad. So I'm standing in front of the door right now. Room 547. I'll knock. All right, he's coming to the door. So here, let me ask you then, how did you get interested in this? What started it all? Did you just wake up one day and say, I want to have a radio station?
I don't know. I always heard, well, I was always a big-time radio listener, okay? And I guess I was always the type of person that said, gee, you know, I could do this better, or I have an idea that I'd like to do this, you know, and I think I could play better music or come up with something better, you know? So I did research on other pirates that were in the UK on FM. But I never thought about like shortwave or medium wave or anything like that. And then I was in high school and somebody said, I know where to find a transmitter. Because I'd always be talking to my friends, yeah, let's get on the radio. Turns out it was a signal generator. So I took the signal generator and tried it. Didn't really do much. And somehow over time I managed to use like cable TV amplifiers, and the Radio Shack used to have an FM amplifier. It was a 25 dB gain, you know, you hook it up to your antenna, your receive antenna, and to your receiver. Well, I put it backwards, like push the signal out towards the antenna from the signal generator, and I was able to get like a couple mile radius with that, you know.
That simple.
Yeah, but the funny thing was the transmitter drifted. Well, the signal generator was very drifty, so it didn't stay on frequency. It drifted quite fast. The only digital tuner I had to check to see if I was on frequency was up in my car, so I would run from the basement all the way up. Press tune, seek, it would go by, come down again, just barely touch the button, and go back and forth and do that.
I should mention, by the way, that when he started up the pirate station that day, he was having some antenna problems. So I lent him an antenna that I had. He connected it up to his transmitter. We went down to his car, and then we started driving around the double tree to see if there were any signal dropouts and anything, and there weren't. It was a very funny experience, very funny indeed. Now, earlier on, I mentioned that a friend of mine from Montreal, Boris Shidov is his name, came down from Montreal to see me and also to visit the SWL Fest himself. Now, Boris and I go way back, more than 20 years. In fact, we worked in radio together a very long time ago. Now, Boris is a little bit like myself. He likes to collect things. Yes, collect things. And he brought a whole stack of cassette tapes. And I was amazed at some of the stuff that was there.
BBC World Service, now here's Michael Hayes with Sports Roundup.
Bayern Munich narrowly escaped defeat in football.
13 hours, Greenwich Mean Time.
BBC World Service. This is Max Easterman and Martin Hanley with a special 45-minute programme of news and background to today's main story, the resignation of the British Prime Minister, Mrs. Margaret Thatcher.
And we're actually now in my hotel room, which is a little bit of a mess. There's tapes everywhere. There's the BBC World Service playing in the background. But actually, it's not the BBC World Service today. It's a programme from when Margaret Thatcher retired, that we're actually broadcasting. We have a 5-watt transmitter. I'm sitting right behind an FM antenna. There's a number of FM stations that are broadcasting. We're just setting it up for some fun, broadcasting all kinds of weird stuff from the past and everything. And somebody who you've heard on the show before came all the way from Montreal to say hello to me, because we haven't seen each other. How long?
I think it's about 15 years now, Keith.
That's right, 15 years. Boris Shidov. And you brought along some tapes, which was really funny to listen to, because more than 20 years ago,
exactly,
on a station in Montreal, we did a show called Short Waves. It wasn't about international broadcasting. It was taking stuff off shortwave and really illustrating to people the kind of thing that you can hear from the BBC World Service, programs like John Peel, the Tony Myatt Request show, BBC Newsreel, which is no longer on, to commentaries from Radio Moscow and all kinds of other
Radio
wacky things, Radio Netherlands. Now, I remember going to your house, and there was something that you had in your house that, if your back was turned, I would have walked away with it. It was a beautiful Cambridge radio.
Which I still have. It was a Cambridge radio originally from the UK that we brought over from the UK, made by Pye from 1958. And if a lot of the people in your audience do remember, a lot of the radios that were in existence in those times worked on valves.
And for our American audience, yeah, that's tubes. Radio tubes, yeah.
Yeah. Radio tubes that were the predecessor of the transistors that you see in modern radios now. And actually, that radio is still working fantastically well, and you can still pick up shortwave stations.
And just a question, does it have the green magic eye?
It has the famous green magic eye that comes together. There are two parts of it. It's difficult to describe to the audience listening, but I would say it's something like from James Bond 007, something akin to a radar, but what you see on TV when a ship is going in, you know, in difficult waters, there's the radar screen. What happens is when you have tuned the station perfectly, mm-hmm. The two
comes
parts
together.
Of that radio come together. So yes, it does have the famous green eye. One of the things it also has is also the famous plate. It's a plate that was a feature in the radio that would give you the positions of all the stations in Europe. So, for instance, if you wanted to listen to Radio Luxembourg in those days, or Radio Caroline, or Moscow, you would actually tune the, I would say, the side bar, I think that's the closest term, that would move up and down, and then it would fix in. So, for instance, if you're looking for London or Paris, mm-hmm. you would move that dial to Paris until you saw this sidebar touch Paris. That means you were tuned in. But
yeah, but you know, I've noticed, and I've heard this from a lot of people,
Bob Zanotti, who's a contributor here, worked at Swiss Radio International. He said that sidebar for him never worked. He said you'd go to Moscow. I think it was just for decoration more than anything, you know?
It was just for decoration. In the UK in those days, in the early 70s, you had BBC Radio 1, 2, 3, and 4, and they did have fixed frequencies on the medium wave band.
Yeah, but international broadcasters change frequencies.
That's right. So they were the only ones that were accurate. Everything else was not accurate. And as the Cold War progressed, all those frequencies changed radically, so it was not accurate. But that radio has a 12-inch wide speaker, so the sound coming from that is just immaculate.
And that was my good friend Boris Shidov. The SWL Fest had a lot of very interesting forums. One of the most fun things was the silent auction that takes place every year. Now, basically what it is people bring all kinds of things, also some junk as well, and then they put it out on these tables, and then underneath the item is a piece of paper, and you write how much you're going to bid on it, and you put your name. And then I think after about an hour or in 2 hours, they say, okay, stop, and the highest bidder, of course, wins. There were all kinds of things, like I said, everything radio-related, and some things that are not even radio-related. I actually won two items at the silent auction. The very famous Bozo box, as it's called, in reference to Bozo the Clown. A bank, there was a Bozo radio, a Bozo light switch, a Bozo on a swing, and a plastic Bozo that you can move the legs about. And I also won an album. And a guy by the name of Tony, who was a very nice guy, very hyper, he won this radio. And I remember after the auction, sitting in the lobby talking to someone. And he was so excited that he got this radio. The radio must have been over 60 years old. And I looked at him and I said, Tony, please don't plug that in. And he said, why not? Why not? I said, look at the wire. Look at the wire. The wire was crumbling apart. I don't think, of course, he would do that. But I'd like to know why he bid on that radio and what he used it for. Did he fix it up? So, Tony, if you're listening, do let me know. I'm really curious about that. The other aspect of the SWL Fest that I thought was quite interesting was there were a number of very odd characters. And I had one experience that happened on the night of David Goran's shortwave shindig. Boris and I, we were sitting in the back. And David Goran's shortwave shindig, if you ever go to the SWL Fest, do attend it because it is a lot of fun. All of a sudden, behind me, there was a guy that sat down. He was wearing a trench coat. And he had one hand. On his other hand was a hook. And he was just sort of sitting there, not really paying attention to anything that was going on. At one point, I decided to get up and go get a drink on the back table. As I did, he came over and he decided to talk to me. First thing he said was, what do you do? And I said, well, I told him, you know. And I said, well, are you here for this festival? And he went, no. I said, well, why are you here? And he said, batteries. And I looked at him and I said, oh, are you going to be giving a talk about what kind of batteries to use in a radio? And he went, no. I said, well, do you have, what do you mean? And he said, let me talk to you outside. So I went with him outside the room. And he went on at length, I don't even know how long, that he was an inventor. And he actually used to work for Duracell and invented a battery that would last 5 years. Yes, a battery that would last 5 years without being charged or anything. And how the big corporate battery giants were out to get him and he needed help. And could I lend him, listen to this, could I lend him $3,000? Well, I mean, at that point, I knew that something was not quite right in his head. And I said, well, look, I have to get back inside. I have a friend waiting in there. Here's my email. I gave him another email that I use from time to time. Email the information. And that was it. Never saw him again. Never saw him again. I'd asked some people who were at the fest. I said, there was this guy here last night. Have you seen him before? And they went, nope. Never heard of him. never seen him before. He just disappeared, vanished into thin air. There were some other odd characters as well. There's one guy whose name has eluded me at the moment, but he's affectionately known as Scarf Man. And that's because of a scarf that he wears around his neck. And I was setting up a transmitter and some other equipment for a little talk that I was giving during some time that Thomas Witherspoon had. And as I was setting up, he kind of came over to me and he started randomly giving out numbers. And I just said to him, "Excuse me?" And he said, "Serial number. What's the serial number?" I said, "Well, I personally really don't know." And he just picked up every item and he was wrote the serial number on a piece of paper and kind of moved on and was saying all kinds of things. He's one of the colorful characters that apparently shows up there every year. Very strange man. Couldn't figure him out. One of the other people that I happened to meet during the festival is somebody who started going a number of years ago. And very strange man. Very strange indeed. But nevertheless, quite intelligent. He was able to build two transmitters and all kinds of other electronic gadgets. But very, very peculiar. I'm talking about Jay Smokestein. Now, Jay, and I'm trying to be kind here, and I'm not making fun of him. He was just strange. He was very peculiar. Couldn't really have a conversation with him. And very, very odd man.
One time I was at Columbia Presbyterian Hospital, 168th Street from Broadway, and I had a roommate. Unlike Mount Kisco's hospital, Northern Westchester, they have two beds in a hospital room in New York City. And they pollo, which in Mount Kisco speak means chicken, and it had bones and fat and things. So I had one of the rooms with the window open, which is pretty unusual. But anyway, we're up like five floors up or something, and when he doesn't want something on his plate, he goes over to the window and drops the food out the window.
And that was Jay Smilkstein, who we found out had passed away only 2 days after attending last year's SWL Fest. Certainly a character that he will be missed greatly this year. If you still want to attend the SWL Fest because it's a week away, you still can. If you're in the area, you can just sort of drop by. I'm sure that Richard Cuff and John Figliozzi, the gracious hosts that they are, will find room for you. To find out more information, you can check out their website, www.swlfest.com. That's www.swlfest.com. And it takes place March 1st and March 2nd.
This is Radio Moscow, and here is the news.
Vous écoutez bien sûr Radio France Internationale.
BBC.
Vous écoutez bien sûr Radio France Internationale.
BBC.
Moscow.
Czechoslovak Radio Prague.
And you're listening to the monthly one-hour edition of Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio. Any foreign correspondent you talk to will tell you one area they want to be posted to is China. Back in the era of the Cultural Revolution, working as a correspondent in China was near to impossible. At the time, there was only a small handful. This changed when China started opening up to the world in the 1980s. So what was it like as a correspondent in the early 70s? And what is it like today? Well, many things have changed, but many things have remained the same. We now have this special documentary from ABC Radio National with a look back at past difficulties and forward to what it's like today. It's produced and presented by Richard Ady.
The ABC opened its bureau in Peking, as it was, in 1973, after Gough Whitlam had recognized China, but before he arrived for an official visit.
Of thousands of Chinese children here at Peking Airport this afternoon,
saying goodbye to Prime Minister Whitlam and the Australian Party travelling with them. What they're calling out is a warm send-off to Prime Minister Whitlam and a warm send-off to distinguished Australian guests. All around the tarmac here in Peking Airport is a blaze of colours.
Paul Raphael, the ABC's first on-the-ground correspondent in China, and a man who'd been absolutely determined to get that job.
I was at Whitlam's place in 72, December, when he won power. Then he came from the motel and, I mean, you couldn't do it now, but with the security, all the nonsense, but you're just in the house and there were a couple of hundred supporters and whatever. And within, I don't know whether it was the next day or fairly quickly, he announced recognition of People's Republic of China. At that point, I definitely knew somebody was going to go from the ABC and open the bureau up there, because it was a prestige thing, it was symbolic, all those things. So I decided that I was going to be it. So they announced that there'd be a reciprocal exchange of reporters. So that's how they did it. You know, the Chinese wanted to get their new China news agency people into our countries because they were spooks. But our people wouldn't let them come in here unless we were given slots there. So they came up. They were going to have three, ABC,
Sydney Morning Herald,
AAP, and Sydney Morning Herald. So I did something I'd never done before, but about a few days after they announced that the ABC would have a correspondent in Peking and open the bureau, I took, again, maybe it doesn't sound unusual now, but then with a kind of the hierarchy and authority, whatever, I took a deep breath one day and wrote a letter to Duck Manton, who you probably know is the general manager.
Yes.
And I wrote to him. I said, I'm the best person for the job. And I said, you know, Parade magazine and this and Sunday Times in London have all printed my stories. And my wife's Chinese and I'm willing to learn Chinese. And so I'm the best person. But a week later, Russell Warner called me and said, you really want to go to China? Is the correspondent? He says, you're mad. He said, you won't be able to report very well there. And he was right, but I didn't care. What I wanted to do was be there. And whatever I could report would be valuable. And he said, you want it? I said, yeah, really. He said, I'll arrange it for you.
On arrival, he quickly realised how difficult reporting would be. And I should tell you, the sound quality of this next bit is not the best.
They're bugged our phones. I know that from two reasons. Once, when the apartment were nearly ready, they allowed my wife to go down and have a look. And she noticed that the door down to the basement was open. So she looked in and she saw all these cubicles. They were not so much concerned about us, they were concerned about the diplomats we shared the building with. During one of these dinners, and they were the only times that we were able to talk to the Chinese, was the foreign ministry, apart from the two trips we had every year, the foreign ministry. And one day, Mr. Shou, who was, Ma Yuchen was in overall control of the 10 or so foreign correspondents. Mr. Shou was the Australian correspondent, and I think. And one day, just to show off, at one of these banquets at the Great Hall of the People, when a leader would come in, he just let slip something to me. The only way he could have known that was by bugging me. And then he smiled at me. Nearly he burst out laughing.
Some things never change.
I work on the assumption that I'm constantly being monitored. So, for example, we assume all our emails are being read or can be read, phone calls can be listened into, even that the car, the ABC car and the ABC office and my house would all be bugged. Now, I don't know the extent to which any of that is true, but you have to work on that assumption. And if you were ever dealing with something that was particularly sensitive, you'd find another way of talking to that person, not using your phone, not using emails. The reason we think this is the case is because there have been numerous times when, you know, I've sent off an email and then, bang, the authorities have been straight back in touch with me. The only way they would have known that is if they'd read the email. Or we go to some remote village and we're covering a sort of dispute over this sort of toxic pollution where people there were dying of cancer. The villagers wanted to talk to us, and in the middle of nowhere, these police and government officials all just turn up there. Now, the only way we thought that they could have known we were there is by probably like tracking our phones. There's a theory going around, actually, that we have these press cards you have to have, like it's an identification. Some of the correspondents think that maybe they've got microchips in them, and that way they could just track us wherever we went anyway. So even if we didn't turn on our phones, they could follow us.
Stephen McDonnell. After Paul Raphael, the next correspondent was Warren Duncan. Here he reports on the funeral of the Premier, Zhou Enlai.
In a ceremony unannounced to foreigners, we saw what amounted to the funeral procession of Mr. Zhou Enlai. A motorcade of about 86 vehicles, one of which was a small bus, obviously contained the body of Zhou Enlai. As the motorcade passed along Peking's main boulevard, something like 100,000 people stood and watched in silence. Many of them were openly weeping.
Today, Beijing is one of the most sophisticated cities in the world. But in the mid-1970s, it wasn't such an easy place for a foreigner to live, especially if you didn't speak Mandarin.
I had a very, very good interpreter who was incredibly professional, and just a maid who was also very good, a bit older and very experienced and remembered the old days. She had worked in a hotel in Tianjin before 49. So she had an idea about foreigners, Westerners' needs and wants. So in fact, she was quite useful because she knew, she just had some idea, whereas a younger woman wouldn't have had any idea of what a cocktail party was or what a dinner party was in our sense. And of course, those things were terribly important. What I used to say was there was no, the entertainment was entertaining. There was no entertainment at all. There was nothing that, you know, we would want to watch or would be entertained by on television. There was no movies to go to. This was the very beginning of videos, and a few people used to get them, and a couple of people had machines. Occasionally you would get to see what was being shown on television in some other part of the world. So entertaining, social activity was incredibly important, so having good staff around was useful for that as well.
One problem was that at the time, all Chinese were encouraged to monitor everyone else's behaviour and report on them to the authorities.
And they had this criticism of people who fawned on foreigners. That was a very, very naughty thing to do, and you could be reported for fawning on foreigners. So if you were to give people something from outside, they could be criticised and maybe lose their job or be moved to somewhere awful. So that was a delicate balancing task. And was one of the things I enjoyed in the latter part of my time there, when after the dismissal of the so-called Gang of Four, who were seen as the hardliners and supporters of Mao, there was a great freeing up. And during my last months, I was able to really enjoy the company of those three people. And by then I could communicate pretty well, and we could go to lunch all together and really enjoy that experience. So that was actually one of the real delights of staying long enough to see the beginnings of change.
In 1983, Helene Chung took over as bureau chief. Here she reports on the expulsion of a fellow foreign correspondent.
Officials have opposed a normal contact between foreigners and locals and tried to restrict foreigners to special compounds. Some of Tetsani's writing was highly critical of the totalitarian regime. One report was about his children's experience in a Chinese school, where they're said to have been systematically segregated and observed. When asked yesterday whether Tetsani was on the list of unfriendly journalists, a foreign ministry spokesman said, "I guess you can make your own judgment."
Helene Chung was actually the first woman the ABC sent overseas as a foreign correspondent, and she naturally wanted to do well. And there was other, more prosaic pressure, too.
I also had, when I arrived, the problem of having to totally refurbish the apartment after 10 years. Because China was a very costly place. I think the figure given to me at the time, or I learnt, was in the order of a quarter of a million or so a year it cost in Beijing. Now, unlike today, where everything is made in China, nothing made in China then worked. Nothing made in China could be used in a bureau. You could not even get envelopes that you could lick. You had to use a pot of paste. Even stamps had to be pasted on with glue. There was no such thing as carbon paper. Now, maybe you've forgotten what carbon paper was, but this was not when everyone used a computer. There was no such thing as a fax machine. Faxes came out in 86 or so. However, they were not in China then. We used a telex machine. That was the form of communication. So everything was pretty backward. I mean, you couldn't have a Chinese-made typewriter. You couldn't have a Chinese-made anything. So all the equipment, even the paint, the carpet, the refrigerators, the stove, everything had to come up from Hong Kong. And the reason the refurbishment had to be left to a new correspondent was it would cost the ABC an arm and a leg, a couple of arms and legs in duty, if it came in of its own accord, not with a newly appointed correspondent.
Refurbishing is something you eventually finish. Other problems you have to wrestle with every day.
It was necessary to go through a Chinese operator to get a line to Sydney. And the lines were so poor, I had to shout to be heard. Everyone had to shout. That's why everyone in China shouts, or one of the reasons. And I would sometimes shout for up to 5 hours through a series of operators, because I'd lose one. I'd finally get through to Sydney. The technician would say, the line's no good. I'd have to go back, wait in my queue, shout through the operator, get through. This would sometimes take 5 hours before I got a line that was almost acceptable for a piece on air. In fact, I shouted so much, I regularly lost my voice. And one year, I lost my voice 5 times, and the newly appointed Australia doctor based in China said, if I didn't watch it, I could lose my voice permanently. Well, clearly I didn't, but so I was very lucky. Now, that, of course, has changed, because there's no problem in communication with China in any form now, even television, instant through to Australia and elsewhere.
It isn't quite as simple as that, of course. Stephen McDonnell.
Most of the gear, you know, of course we've got sort of modern gear these days, and it works a treat when it works. The biggest problem is internet speeds, especially if we're on the road. Like now, if we hit somewhere, the first thing we'll try and do is test the internet speeds in the hotel, for example, because you have to be sending all this material back el pronto. Like, they expect it potentially within minutes, depending on where you are. And so we're battling that internet speed all the time, even in the bureau. What makes it even worse is that to get around the so-called Great Firewall of China, you need to use a virtual private network, a VPN.
Yeah.
So to look at any sites that are blocked, anything or not be subject to Chinese censorship, you need to use this. Again, this slows down the computer speed. So this is our biggest headache. It's computer speed. And that means logging on and looking at websites, or it means filing via FTP, because we file over the internet these days. Even from the bureau, we file from the internet. So that's our biggest headache.
Actually, that speed, the other side of it, of course, is that you are expected to file a lot more than previous correspondents.
Sometimes we joke about this, that our bosses, when they're all in the field, they never had to do it, but they expect us to. But, for example, you know, recently we had a big court case that we had to cover. Now, we're expected to do, well, let me think, 7 radio news stories, 2 or 3 radio current affairs stories, a 7 p.m. and a late line television story, then possibly a bit of a rant, as we call it, where we're just talking to the camera for News 24, and any other crosses to, it could be anything from Metro Radio to News Radio. Then by the time we've done all of that, we start working on the AM piece for the next morning. And that's without even filing to other platforms like the internet, for example, the ABC website. They'd love us to write articles for them, but we just don't have time to do it.
The explosion of demands on correspondents in terms of the different outlets they have to service really began in the 90s. Jane Hutchin arrived in Beijing in 1995. She'd grown up in Hong Kong, was fluent in Cantonese, and had learnt Mandarin. But as you'll hear, knowing the language will only take you so far.
This is quite bad, but I know there's worse pollution further down the road. I don't understand why we're coming to the electricity plant. Why won't you let me choose the place myself? Well, if there's nothing to see, then why can't we look for ourselves? What is the problem?
That's from a foreign correspondent story in 1996. Getting it was hard work.
We ended up finding this locality along the Huai River that, you know, literally the river there had gone black and it was dead. And to actually get to talk to those people, though, because when we were with the officials, the buses would go speeding past these very black bits. And we were very lucky one day because we were actually held up by a massive traffic jam because there was some kind of road work going on. So we said, oh, we'll get out here and start filming. And before they could stop us, we were out filming. A massive group of locals had gathered around us and they started complaining about the government and said, does the government see what they're doing? And what about our lives? We can't live if the river's dead. There's no fish, and they took us down. And indeed, the river was bubbling. It was that kind of disgusting. It was just bubbling. And we filmed it because they couldn't really stop us. You know, they were calling people on their phones, but they couldn't really stop us because it had just happened. But then the shutters came down and they didn't really want to take us to the factory that we'd asked to go, the factory that was causing a lot of the pollution. And so we had already brought with us a small digital camera. And what we tried to do was to contact the people that we wanted to speak to and go and visit them in the evening where, you know, say goodbye to the officials after our nice big banquet, go home, say we're very, very tired, it's 6:30, oh, we're so tired, we want to be ready for tomorrow, and then we'd jump in a taxi and go out and film the people that we wanted to speak to. And they were on to us, of course, and they realised when we all sort of got out together, even though we weren't carrying a big camera with us, that we were up to something. So that's what happened. There was a taxi chase through a very, very crowded small city, in and out of markets. Then we would jump out. We would separate. It was a real hullabaloo. We eventually did manage to shake our tail and speak to some people who had lived by the river, who collected the water for us to show us what, you know, they were having to live by because they didn't have tapped water then. And it made a fascinating story, but of course the officials were not pleased.
And if you displeased someone official, you had to atone, sometimes by writing something called a self-criticism.
It never happened to me in the foreign ministry in Beijing itself. I wasn't told to write one there, but in smaller municipalities, I was made to write several self-confessions. Now, I didn't have a big problem with this because I knew that my role as the leader of the team was to take the responsibility. So if I made it all my fault, that means that our Chinese assistants who worked for us would not be punished because it was me, their leader, telling them to do something, and none of the other team would be responsible because I was the evil person that ordered them to do this thing. So that's really what it was about, just to say that I was responsible. I told them to go out on the street and film this protest or this disgusting water, and I take responsibility for this.
Some things haven't changed about China over the last 40 years. Some things have changed enormously. And the ABC correspondents have changed too. The early ones didn't have Mandarin. Now they do, which makes an enormous difference. Though it doesn't mean there isn't room for confusion. Stephen McDonnell.
Well, these days, Beijing is a big modern metropolis, and they are used to foreigners there, and they're also used to foreigners who speak Chinese. So with white face, you can get into a cab and start talking to a cabbie in Mandarin, and they won't think it's weird. But if you were to leave, say, Beijing, Shanghai, or Guangzhou, and go to smaller places, it would still freak them out a bit. Wow, not only a foreigner, but a foreigner speaking Chinese. So those big metropolises, you know, you can get any sort of food you would want. It's like being in Sydney or Melbourne or something like that. And that they're quite sophisticated places. But the further you leave the big cities, the more strange it would be to someone to encounter a foreigner.
And so you have to kind of get around that, whoa, I'm freaking you out, but I want you to talk to me.
It's funny, sometimes, I remember I once went up to a lady just selling fruit, like sort of little old lady, had a stall, and this was actually just on the outskirts of Beijing, but it's a real knockabout part of town, and where local villagers who live on the outskirts of Beijing come and buy their fruit and things like that. And I just wanted to do a little interview with her, and so I came up and I start asking her questions, and she looks at me and she's just speaking at 100 miles an hour, telling me, you know, I can't speak English, blah, 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 or I can't speak your language. And she's just firing, and I'm just trying to get her to calm down and say, listen, I am speaking your language, okay? If you just that wouldn't have, you know, occurred to her that a foreigner could possibly speak Mandarin. Yeah, so it is quite funny in that way.
Stephen McDonnell, still right in the middle of things in Beijing. Jane Hutchin finished at the beginning of 2001, wrote a book about her experiences, and then took up big postings in the Middle East and London. So how does she look back on her time in China?
Well, level of satisfaction, it was the best, so I'd have to say 10. Degree of difficulty, that was also very, very difficult, so probably a 9.5 to 10 in terms of how hard it was. But it was such a great time. It was pre a lot of the amazing technological advances that we have now. I mean, we used to have to drive, for example, 45 minutes through traffic, an hour through traffic, just to get our tapes to be able to satellite them back to Australia. Now they're done in the bureau with a push of a button. So it was a very different time. But I appreciate that, because in a way I got to see China before the whole gloss of the Olympics arrived. I think I got to see a real nation that was in the throes of an incredible reform.
Well, with that, we've just about come to the end of another program here on the monthly edition of Media Network Plus. If you'd like to contact us, do drop us a line at mnp@pcjmedia.com. And MNP, of course, stands for Media Network Plus. So that email address again, mnp@pcjmedia.com. If you'd like to listen to this show again or past editions of either the 55-minute or the 30-minute edition of Media Network Plus, just go to our website, www.pcjmedia.com/Media Network Plus, all one word. So until next time, on behalf of Dan Hensley and Keith Petal, this is Paulette McQuarrie in Vancouver, Canada, saying so long and see you again soon.